now smoking a cigarette. Chu was sitting on the arm of the couch, keeping watch. "I made him turn off the tank," he said, "so he wouldn't blow us all up."
"There's nothing in the tank," Bosch said.
"What?"
Bosch didn't answer. He moved across the room until he was standing directly in front of Hardy.
"Stand up."
Hardy looked up, a confused look on his face.
"I said stand up."
"What's going on?"
Bosch reached down with both hands, grabbed him by the shirt, and yanked him up out of the chair. He spun him around and pushed him face first against the wall.
"Harry, what are you doing?" Chu asked. "He's an old..."
"It's him," Bosch said.
"What?"
"It's the son, not the father."
Bosch pulled his handcuffs off his belt and bound Hardy's arms behind his back.
"Chilton Hardy, you're under arrest for the murder of Lily Price."
Hardy said nothing as Bosch recited his constitutional rights. He turned his cheek to the wall and even had a small smile on his face.
"Harry, is the father upstairs?" Chu asked from behind him.
"No."
"Then where is he?"
"I think he's dead.
Junior's been living here as him collecting his pension and Social Security and all that stuff. Open the file. Where's the DL photo?" Chu stepped forward with a blow-up shot of Chilton Aaron Hardy, Jr. Bosch turned Hardy around and then held him against the wall with one hand on his chest. He held the photo up next to his face. He then flicked the thick eyeglasses off him, and they fell to the floor.
"It's him."
He shaved his head for the DL photo, changed his appearance. "We never pulled up his father's photo.
I guess we should have."
Bosch handed the photo back to Chu. Hardy's smile grew broader.
"You think this is funny?"
Bosch asked. Hardy nodded.
"I think it's pretty fucking funny that you don't have any evidence and you don't have a case."
His voice was different now, a deeper timbre, not the fragile old man's voice from before.
"And I think it's pretty fucking funny that you searched this place illegally. No judge is going to believe I gave you permission. Too bad you didn't find anything. I'd love watching the judge throw it all out."
Bosch grabbed a handful of Hardy's shirt and pulled him off the wall, then slammed him back against it. He felt his rage building.
"Hey, partner," he said, "go out to the car and get your computer. I want to write up a search warrant right now."
"Harry, I already checked on my phone. There's no Wi-Fi here. How are we going to send it in?"
"Partner, just go get the computer. We'll worry about Wi-Fi after you write it up, and close the door when you leave."
"Okay, partner, I'll go get the laptop."
Message received. Bosch never took his eyes off Hardy's. He saw them register the situation, that he was about to be left alone with Bosch, and the beginning of fear entered their shiny coldness. As soon as he heard the front door close, Bosch pulled his Glock and pushed the muzzle into the flesh under Hardy's chin.
"Guess what, asshole? We're going to end this right here, because you're right. We don't have enough, and I'm not letting you run free another fucking day."
He violently yanked Hardy off the wall and spun him to the floor. Hardy crashed into the side table, knocking the ashtray and water glass onto the rug and landed on his back. Bosch dropped down on him, straddling his torso.
"The way this will work is we didn't know it was you see. We thought it was your father all along, and when my partner went out to the car, you jumped me. There was a struggle for the gun, and guess what? You didn't win."
Bosch held the gun up sideways, displaying it in front of Hardy's face.
"There will be two shots, the one I'm about to put through your black fucking heart, and then after I take off the cuffs, I'll wrap your dead hands around my Glock and cap one into the wall. That way we both get gunshot residue and everybody's cool with it."
Bosch leaned down and positioned the gun with the barrel at an upward angle to Hardy's chest.
"Yeah, I think like this," he said.
"Wait," Hardy yelled. "You can't do this."
In his eyes, Bosch saw true terror.
"This is for Lily Price and Clayton Pell and everybody else you killed and hurt and destroyed."
"Please!"
"Please? Is that what Lily said to you? Did she say please?"
Bosch changed the angle of the gun slightly and leaned further down, his chest now only 6 inches from Hardy's.
Okay, I admit it. Venice Beach, 1989. I'll tell you everything. Just take me in and set it up. I'll tell you about my father, too. I drowned him in the bathtub.
Bosch shook his head. You'll tell me what I want to hear just to get out of here alive. But it's no good, Hardy. It's too late. We're past that. Even if you truly confessed, it wouldn't hold up. Coerced confession. You know that.
Bosch pulled back the slide on the Glock to chamber around. I don't want a bullshit confession. I want evidence. I want your stash.
What stash?
You keep stuff. All you guys keep stuff. Pictures, souvenirs. You want to save yourself, Hardy? Tell me where the stash is.
He waited. Hardy said nothing. Bosch put the muzzle down against his chest and angled the gun again.
All right, Hardy said desperately. Next door. Everything's next door. My father owned both places. I have it set up with a phony name on the deed. You go look, you'll find everything you need.
Bosch stared down at him for a long moment. If you're lying, you're dying. He withdrew the gun and holstered it. He started to get up. How do I get in?
The keys are on the counter in the kitchen.
The odd smile returned to Hardy's face. A moment ago, he was desperate to save his own life. Now he was smiling. Bosch realized it was a look of pride.
Go check it out, Hardy urged. You're going to be famous, Bosch. You caught the goddamn record holder.
Yeah? How many?
37. I planted 37 crosses.
Bosch had guessed that there were going to be numbers, but not that high. He wondered if Hardy was inflating his kills as part of one last manipulation. Say anything, give anything, just to get out the door alive. All he had to do was survive this moment, and he could slip into the next transformation, from unknown and uncharted killer to figure of public fascination and fear, a name that would inspire dread. Bosch knew it was part of the fulfillment process with their kind. Hardy had probably lived in anticipation of the time he would become known. Men like him fantasized about it. In one smooth and swift move, Bosch pulled the Glock from his holster again and brought its aim down on Hardy.
No! Hardy yelled. We have a deal!
We don't have shit.
Bosch pulled the trigger. The metal snap of the firing mechanism sounded, but there was no bullet in the chamber. The gun was empty. Bosch nodded. Hardy had missed the tell. No cop would have had to chamber around because no cop would have left the chamber empty. Not in L.A., where the 2 seconds it takes to chamber around could cost you your life. That had been just part of the play, in case Bosch had to string it out. He reached down and rolled Hardy over so he was face down. He put the gun down on his back and from his suit pocket took out 2 snap ties. He cinched one around Hardy's ankles, binding them tightly together, and then used the other on his wrists so he could remove his handcuffs. Bosch had a feeling that he would not be the one escorting Hardy to jail, and he didn't want to lose his cuffs. Bosch stood up and hooked his cuffs back on his belt. He then reached back into his coat pocket and took out a handful of bullets. He ejected the empty magazine from his gun and started reloading it. When he had finished, he slid the magazine back into place and racked 1 bullet into the chamber before returning the weapon to its holster.
Always keep 1 in the chamber, he said to Hardy.
The door opened and Chu stepped back in, carrying his laptop. He looked at Hardy lying prone on the floor. He had no idea what Bosch's play had been.
Is he alive?
Yes, unfortunately. Watch him. Make sure he doesn't do the kangaroo.
Bosch walked down the hallway to the kitchen and found a set of keys on the counter where Hardy said they would be.
When he came back to the living room, he looked around trying to figure out a way of securing Hardy while he and Chu conferred privately outside about how to proceed.
An embarrassing story went around the PAB a few months earlier about a robbery suspect dubbed the Kangaroo. He had been bound at the ankles and wrists and left on the floor of a bank while the arresting officers looked for another suspect they believed was hiding. 15 minutes later, officers in another responding car saw a man hopping down the street 3 blocks from the bank. Finally, Bosch got an idea.
"Get the end of the couch," he said.
"What are we doing?" Chu asked.
Bosch pointed him to the end. "Tip it."
They tipped the couch forward on its front legs and then down over Hardy. It tented him and made it almost impossible for him to try to stand up with his arms and legs bound.
"What is this?" Hardy protested. "What are you doing?"
"Just sit tight, Hardy," Bosch replied. "We won't leave you too long."
Bosch signaled Chu toward the front door. As they were going out, Hardy called out,
"Be careful, Bosch!"
Bosch looked back at him.
"Of what?"
"Of what you'll see. You won't be the same after today."
Bosch stood with his hand on the knob for a long moment. He could only see Hardy's feet extending from under the overturned couch.
"We'll see," he said.
He stepped out and closed the door.
Chapter 36.
It was like being at the end of a maze and having to work their way back to the starting point. They had the location they wanted to search, the townhouse next door where Hardy claimed he kept his stash of keepsakes from his kills. They just had to figure out the chain of events and legal steps bringing them to it that could be put in a search warrant and that would be accepted and approved by a superior court judge. Bosch did not reveal to Chu what had occurred in Hardy's living room while Chu had gone back to the car. Not only was there the trust issue that had exploded on the Irving case, but Bosch had no doubt coerced a confession from Hardy, and he would not share that transgression with anyone. If, and more likely, when Hardy claimed coercion as part of his defense, Bosch would simply deny it and dismiss it as an outrageous defense tactic. There would be no possibility of anyone other than Hardy, the accused, being able to attack his story. So Bosch told Chu what they needed to do, and they worked out how to get there. Chilton Hardy Sr., who is most likely dead, is supposed to be the owner of these 2 apartments. We need to search them both, and we need to do it code 3. How do we get there? They were standing on the grass in front of the townhome complex. Chu looked at the facades of units 6A and 6B as if the answer to the question might be painted on them like graffiti. "Well, probable cause on 6B is not going to be a problem," he said. "We found him there living as his father. We're entitled to search for any indication of what happened to the old man. Exigent circumstances, Harry. We're in."
"And what about 6A?
That's the place we really want.
So
Okay, I think I got it. We came down to interview Chilton Hardy Sr., but we realized halfway through that the guy in front of us is actually Chilton Hardy Jr. There is no sign of Hardy Sr., and we're thinking he might be tied up somewhere, being held captive. Who knows what? Maybe he's alive and maybe he's dead. So we run a history search on the property appraiser's database, and lo and behold, he used to own the place right next door, and the transfer of title looks phony. We have an obligation to go in there to see if he is alive or in some kind of peril. Exigent circumstances again." Bosch nodded but frowned at the same time. He didn't like it. It sounded to him like exactly what it was, a story made up to get them in the door. A judge might sign the search warrant, but they'd have to find a friendly one. He wanted something bulletproof, something any judge would approve, and that would hold up upon subsequent legal challenges. He realized he had their access right in his hand. In more ways than one, he held up the key ring. There were 6 keys on it. One was obviously to a vehicle and carried the Dodge logo on it. There were 2 full-size Schlage keys that he assumed were the keys to the front doors of the apartments, and then 3 smaller keys. 2 of these were the small keys used to open private mailboxes,
like the kind they had passed out at the curb.
"The keys," he said. "He's got 2 mailbox keys. Come on."
They headed to the bank of mailboxes. When they got there, Bosch tried the keys in the boxes assigned to Complex 6. He was able to open the boxes for Units 6A and 6B. He noted that the name on 6A was Drew, which Bosch took as an attempt at humor on Hardy's part. Hardy and Drew living side by side in Los Alamitos.
"Okay, we've found 2 mailbox keys in Hardy's possession," he said. "That led us here, and we learned that he had access to 2 boxes, Units 6A and B. We note also that he had 2 Schlage deadbolt keys, and this leads us to believe he has access to both 6A and B. We checked the ownership records and see the transfer from the father on 6B. It doesn't look right because it took place after we think the son started playing the father. So we need to check out A to see if the old man is being held there. We knocked, got no answer, and now we want permission to go in."
Chu nodded. He liked it.
"I think it works. You want me to write it up that way?"
"Yeah, do it. Go write it up inside so you can keep an eye on Hardy."
Bosch hefted the keyring in his hand.
"I'm going in 6A to see if this is worth our while."
It was called jumping the warrant, checking a place out before a search has officially been approved by a judge. If it was ever acknowledged as a police practice, people would lose their badges, even end up in jail. But the truth was that many were the times that search warrants were authored with full knowledge of what would be found in the targeted structure or vehicle. This was because the police had already been inside.
"You sure you need to, Harry?" Chu asked.
"Yeah. If Hardy made a play on me while I was playing him, then I want to know sooner rather than later, so we aren't spinning our wheels. Then just wait till I'm inside so I don't know about it."
Bosch gestured toward the door of 6B like a maitre d' with his arm out and his body slightly bent at the waist.
Chu headed back to the townhouse, but then stopped and came back.
"When are we going to tell the other LAPD that we're here and what we're doing?"
"What other LAPD?"
"Los Alamitos Police Department."
"Not quite yet," Bosch said. "When we get an approval on the warrant, we can call them in."
"They're not going to like that."
"Tough shit. Our case, our arrest." Bosch knew that a department the size of Los Alamitos could easily be bigfooted by the real LAPD. Chu started toward the door to 6B again, and Bosch headed back to the car. He popped the trunk and from the equipment box took several pairs of latex gloves and put them into his coat pocket. He grabbed a flashlight, in case it was needed, and closed the trunk.
Bosch walked back to 6A, but was distracted by the sound of yelling coming from 6B as he approached. It was Hardy.
Bosch went through the door of 6B. Hardy was still lying prone under the couch. Chu was sitting on a chair he had brought out from the kitchen and working on his laptop. Hardy went silent as Bosch entered.
"What's he yelling about?"
"First he wanted a cigarette, now he wants his attorney." Bosch looked down at the overturned couch.
"As soon as you're booked, you get your phone call."
"Then book me."
"We are securing the scene first, and if you keep yelling, then we are going to further secure you with a gag."
"I'm entitled to an attorney. You said so yourself."
"You'll get the phone call when everyone else gets the phone call. When you're booked."
Bosch turned back toward the door.
"Hey, Bosch."
He turned back.
"Did you go in yet?"
Bosch didn't answer. Hardy continued.
"They're going to make movies about us."
Chu glanced up and exchanged a look with Bosch.
There were killers who got off on their infamy and the fear their legends created. Real-life boogeymen, urban myth becoming urban reality. Hardy had stayed hidden for so many years. Now it would be his turn in the spotlight.
"Sure," Bosch said. "You're going to be the most famous asshole on death row."
"Please,"
You know I'll be able to beat the needle for 20 years, at least. Who do you think will play me in the movie?"
Bosch didn't answer. He stepped out onto the stoop and casually glanced around to see if there were any nearby pedestrians or motorists. It was clear. He quickly walked to the door of 6A and pulled Hardy's keyring out of his pocket. He tried one of the Schlage keys on the deadbolt and got lucky with his first try. The key also fit the knob lock. He pushed the door open and entered, then closed it behind him. Bosch stood still in the entry, pulling on a set of latex gloves. The place was as dark as night. He swept the wall with his freshly gloved hand until he found a switch. A dim ceiling light exposed 6A as a house of horrors. A false wall had been built across the front windows, ensuring darkness and privacy, as well as a layer of soundproofing. All four walls of the front room had been used as a gallery for photo collages and newspaper stories of murder and rape and torture. Newspapers from as far as San Diego, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. Stories about unexplained abductions, body dumps, missing people. It was clear that if these cases were the work of Hardy, then he was a traveler. His hunting territory was immense. Bosch studied the photos. Hardy's victims were both young men and women. Some were children. Bosch moved slowly, studying the horrible images. He stopped when he came to a full front page of the Los Angeles Times, yellowed and cracked now, with the smiling face of a young girl in a photo next to a story about her disappearance from a West Valley mall. He leaned closer to read the story until it said her name. He knew the name and the case, and he now remembered why the address on Hardy's driver's license had been familiar to him. Eventually, he had to break away from the ghastly images. This was a pre-search sweep. He had to keep moving. When he came to the door to the garage, Bosch knew what he would find before he opened it. There in the bay sat a white work van, Hardy's most important abduction tool. It was a late model Dodge. Bosch used the key to unlock it and look inside. It was empty except for a mattress and a hanging tool rack with two rolls of duct tape on it. Bosch put the key in the ignition and started the engine so he could check the mileage. The van had over 140,000 miles on it, another indication of the killer's territory. Bosch killed the engine and relocked the van. Bosch had seen enough to know what they had, but he was drawn upstairs anyway. He checked the front bedroom first and found it empty of furniture. All that was here were several small piles of clothing. There were T-shirts with pop stars' faces on them, several pairs of blue jeans, separate piles for just bras and underwear and belts. The clothing of the victims. The walk-in closet had a hasp and padlock on it. Bosch pulled the keyring again and fitted the smallest key into the padlock. He opened the closet door and flicked on the switch on the outside wall. The small room was empty. The walls, ceiling, and floor had been painted black. Two thick steel eye bolts protruded from the back wall, 3 feet off the ground. It was clearly a storage room for Hardy's victims. Bosch thought about all of the people who had spent their last hours in this room, gagged, secured to the bolts, waiting for Hardy to end their agony. In the back bedroom, there was a bed with a bare mattress on it. In the corner was a camera tripod without a camera. Bosch opened the closet doors and found it to be the electronics center. Video cameras, archaic still and Polaroid cameras. There was a laptop computer, and the upper shelves were lined with DVD cases and VHS tapes. On one of the shelves, there were 3 old shoeboxes. Bosch pulled one down and opened it. It was filled with old Polaroids, mostly bleached out now, depicting many different young women and men engaged in oral sex with a man whose face was never seen. Bosch put the box back in its place and closed the closet doors. He went back into the hallway. The bathroom was just as dirty as the bathroom in 6B, but the tub ring was brownish red, and Bosch knew that this was where Hardy washed the blood off. He backed out of the room and checked the hallway closet. It was empty except for a black plastic case that stood about 4.5 feet high and was roughly the shape of a bowling pin. There was a handle on the top of it. Bosch grabbed it and tipped it forward. There were two wheels on the bottom, and he rolled it out into the hallway. The case felt empty, and Bosch wondered if it had contained a musical instrument. But then he saw a manufacturer's plate on the side of the container. It said Golf Plus Go Systems, and Bosch realized it was a case for transporting golf clubs on planes. He laid it down on the carpet and opened it, noting that the two latches could be locked with a key. It was empty, but as he had opened it, Bosch saw that there were three rough-edged holes, the size of dimes, cut into the top facing of the container. Bosch closed it, righted it, and put it back in the closet to be found later during the official search. He closed the closet door and headed back downstairs. As he was halfway down the stairs, Bosch suddenly stopped and gripped the banister. He knew the dime-sized holes in the golf bag carrier were to allow air into the case, and he knew a child or small person could be fit inside. The inhumanity and depravity suddenly seized him. He could smell the blood. He could hear the muffled pleas. He knew the misery of this place. He leaned into the wall for a moment and then slid down to a seated position on the steps. He leaned forward with his elbows on his knees. He was hyperventilating and tried to slow down his breathing cycle. He ran a hand back through his hair and then held the hand across his mouth. He closed his eyes and remembered another time when he was in a place of death, huddled in a tunnel and far from home. He was really just a boy then, and he was scared and trying to control his breathing. That was the key. Control your breathing, and you control the fear. He sat there for no more than 2 minutes, but it seemed like an entire night went by. Finally, his breathing returned to normal, and the memory of the tunnels faded. His phone buzzed, and it brought him out of the dark moment. He pulled it and looked at the screen. It was Chu.
Yeah?
Harry, you okay over there? You're taking a long time.
I'm cool. I'll be over in a minute.
Are we good? Meaning, did Bosch find what they needed in 6A?
Yeah, we're good.
He disconnected and then called Tim Marcia's direct number. He obliquely explained to the squad whip what was going on.
We're going to need people down here, Bosch said. I think there's going to be a lot of work to do. We're also going to need media relations and a liaison with the locals. We should set up a command post, because we're going to be here all week.
Okay, I'm on it, Marcia said. I'll talk to the lieutenant and we'll start mobilizing. It sounds like we're going to need to send everybody.
That would be good.
Are you all right, Harry? You sound weird.
I'm all right.
Bosch gave him the address and hung up. He sat still for another 2 minutes and then made the next call to Kisman Ryder's cell. Harry, I know why you're calling, and all I can tell you is that it was thought out very carefully. A decision was made that was best for the department, and we're never going to talk about it. It's best that way for you, too.
She was talking about the Times story on Irving and the taxi franchise.
The case seemed so distant to Bosch now, and so meaningless.
That's not why I'm calling.
Oh, then what's up? You don't sound right.
I'm fine. We just took down a big one that I'm sure the chief's going to want to get in on.
You remember the Mandy Phillips case up in the West Valley about 9-10 years ago?
No, refresh me.
13 years old. She got grabbed at a mall out there, never found. Nobody ever arrested.
You got the guy?
Yeah. And get this. When he got a driver's license 3 years ago, he gave the girl's address as his own. Ryder was silent as she registered Hardy's audacity.
I'm glad you got him, she finally said.
She's not the only one. We're down in Orange County, putting it together. But it's going to get big. The guy claims his number is 37.
Oh, my God.
He's got a closet full of cameras and photos and tapes. There are VHS tapes, kids. This guy's been at this a very long time. Bosch knew he was taking a risk in revealing to Ryder what he had found while jumping the warrant. They had been partners once, but the bulletproof bond they shared then was now rusting through. Still, he risked it. Politics and high jingo aside, if he couldn't trust her, then he could trust no one.
You told Lieutenant Duvall all of this?
I told the whip. Not everything, but enough. I think they're coming down with everybody.
Okay. I'll check in and monitor things. I don't know if the chief will go down there, but he'll want to get involved. They may want to use the theater here for something like this.
The PAB complex had a ground-level theater that was used for award programs, special events, and major press conferences. This would be one of those. Okay, but that wasn't the main reason I called.
Well, what was the main reason?
Did you do anything yet about moving my partner out of the unit?
No, I've been a little busy this morning.
Good. Then don't. Never mind that.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay, then.
And that other thing you mentioned, about me getting the whole 5 years on the drop, is that something you still think you can do?
I was pretty sure I could get it done when I made the offer.
After this case, I think it's a cinch. They're going to want to keep you around, Harry.
You're about to get famous.
I don't want to be famous. I just want to work cases.
I understand that. I'll go for the full 5.
Thanks, kids. And I guess I should get back to it now. A lot going on here.
Good luck, Harry. Keep it between the lines.
Meaning don't break the rules. The case is too big, too important. Got it.
And Harry?
Yeah?
This is why we do this. Because of people like this guy. Monsters like him. They don't stop until we stop them. It's noble work. Remember that. Just think how many people you just saved.
Bosch nodded and thought about the golf bag carrier. He knew it was going to be something that stayed with him forever. Hardy had been right when he warned that going into 6A would change Bosch. Not enough, he said. He disconnected and thought about things. 2 days ago, he didn't think he could leg out the last 39 months of his career. Now he wanted the full 5 years. Whatever his failings were on the Irving case, he now understood that the mission didn't end. There was always the mission and always work to be done. His kind of work. This is why we do this. Bosch nodded. Kiz got that right. He used the banister to pull himself up to a standing position and then started down the stairs again. He needed to get out of the townhouse and into the sunlight. Chapter 37. By noon, a search warrant had been signed by Superior Court Judge George Campagnoni, and the horrors contained inside Townhouse 6A were officially and legally confirmed by Bosch, Chu, and other members of the Open Unsolved Unit. Chilton Hardy was then moved to one of the squad's cars and transported to the Metropolitan Detention Center for booking by Detectives Baker and Keogh. Bosch and Chu, as the lead investigators, remained behind to work the crime scene. Soon the street outside the side-by-side townhouses, where Hardy had lived as his father and carried out his ghastly desires, took
took on a circus atmosphere as reports of the horrific findings drew more investigators and law enforcement officers, as well as forensic technicians and the media from two counties. It would not be long before tiny Los Alamitos attracted the attention of the entire world, as the story was catapulted onto every news site on the Internet, as well as the cable and broadcast television networks. A jurisdictional squabble between the two LAPDs was quickly settled in favor of the Los Angeles handling all of the investigative aspects of the case, while Los Alamitos was given site security as well as crowd and media control. The latter included a traffic shutdown on the block and an evacuation of all other residents in the 6-unit townhouse complex where Hardy lived and operated. Both sides dug in for what was expected to be a minimum week-long crime scene investigation. Both sides brought in on-site media spokesmen to handle the expected crush of reporters, cameras, and satellite trucks that would descend on the once quiet neighborhood. The chief of police and the commander of the robbery homicide division put their heads together and created an investigative battle plan that had at least one immediate surprise attached. Lieutenant Duval, supervisor of the Open on Solve unit, was aced out of running the show. What would be arguably her unit's finest hour and most important investigation was placed in the hands of Lieutenant Larry Gandel, another RHD squad leader who had more experience than Duval and was considered far more media savvy. Gandel would direct the ongoing investigation. Bosch couldn't complain about the move. He had been on Gandel's homicide team previous to his assignment in OU, and they had worked well together. Gandel was a roll-up-his-sleeves kind of guy who trusted his investigators. He was not the kind of supervisor who hid behind closed doors and shuttered blinds. One of the first moves Gandel made after conferring with Bosch and Chu was to call for a meeting of all the investigators on the scene. They stood together in the dark front room of Unit 6A, after Gandel temporarily shooed a team of forensic photographers and technicians out.
"Okay, people, listen up," he said.
"I didn't think we should meet together outside in the sunshine and fresh air. I thought it would be better for us to be in here where it's dark and it stinks of death. The indications are that many people died in this place and that they died horribly. They were tortured and murdered, and we must respect them and honor them by doing our very best work here. We cut no corners, we bend no rules, we do it right. I don't care if this guy Hardy is riding in that car right now with Baker and Keogh and confessing his ass off. We are going to put together a case that is absolutely fucking bulletproof. We all make the vow right now that this guy never sees the light of day again. Destination, death row. Nothing else. Everybody got that?" There were a few nods across the room. It was the first time Bosch had ever seen the lieutenant giving a pep talk, like a football coach. Harry liked it and thought it was a good move to remind everyone in the room how high the stakes were with the investigation. After the preamble, Gandel proceeded to divide responsibilities among the teams. While much of the investigation inside the two townhouses would involve the gathering of forensic evidence, the heart of the case would involve the videos found in the second bedroom closet and the photos taped to the walls throughout the townhouse. The OU investigators would be charged with documenting who the victims were, where they came from, and what exactly happened to them. It would be a terribly grim task. Earlier, Chu had put one of the DVDs from the bedroom closet into his computer so that he and Bosch could get a sense of what was on the vast collection of tapes and discs. The video showed Hardy raping and torturing a woman to the point that she began begging him, after he pulled down her gag, to kill her and simply put her out of her misery. The video ended with the woman choked unconscious, but clearly still breathing, and Hardy turning to his camera and smiling. He had gotten what he wanted from her. In all of his years as a cop, Bosch had seen nothing so gut-wrenching and horrible. There were images on that one disc that he knew were indelible, and that he would have to try to push into the recesses of his mind. But there were dozens more discs and tapes and hundreds of photographs. Each would need to be viewed, described, catalogued, and placed into evidence. It was going to be painful, soul-searing work, guaranteed to leave the kind of internal scars only homicide cops carry. Gandil said that he wanted everyone in the unit to be open to discussing the harrowing duty with therapists in the department's behavioral science unit. Every cop knew that quietly carrying the horrors of the job inside could be like carrying untreated cancer. Still, seeking help for dealing with the burden was seen by many as a weakness. No cop wanted to be weak, whether it was in the view of the bad guys or their fellow good guys. Gandil next turned the meeting over to Bosch and Chu, the lead investigators, and they quickly summarized the steps that led them to Hardy and the side-by-side townhouses. They also discussed the dichotomy in the investigation that they now faced. There was a need for speed on one level, but also a necessity to move deliberately and carefully to ensure that they conducted the most thorough investigation possible. The department was under the legal obligation to file charges against Hardy within 48 hours of his arrest. He would be brought into court for his first appearance before a judge on Wednesday morning. If by then he was not charged with a crime, he would be released. "What we're going to do is file one case against him," Bosch said. "One murder now, and then we add on later when we're ready with the rest. So on Wednesday, we go with Lily Price. Right now, it's a wobbler, but it's still our best bet. We have a DNA hit, and while it's not Hardy, we think we can prove it puts him at the scene. What we're hoping is that between now and Wednesday morning, we find an image of Lily somewhere in this place." Chu held up a 5x7 photo of Lily Price, taken from the original murder book. It was her yearbook photo. She was smiling and innocent and beautiful. If they found her image anywhere among Hardy's souvenirs, it wouldn't be the same. "We're talking 1989, so she won't be on any of the DVDs unless we find out that Hardy was transferring VHS to DVD," Chu said. "But this is unlikely, as there is no transfer machine here, and this isn't the kind of thing you send out to have done."
"We're going to take a quick run at the still photos," Bosch said. "Those of you working the VHS, keep an eye out for her. If we find her on one of this guy's tapes or photos, then we're gold on Wednesday." When Bosch and Chu were finished, Gandil took back the lead to wrap things up with a final rally cry. "Okay, people," he said, "that's it. We all know what we have to do, so let's do it. Make it count." The group started to break up. Bosch could feel an air of urgency among the detectives. Gandil's charge had worked.
"Oh, one other thing," Gandil said. "No time limitations on the work on this. We have full overtime authorization, and that comes directly from the chief's office."
If the lieutenant was expecting a cheer or even a round of applause, he was disappointed. There was little reaction to the good news that money would flow unabated into the investigation. OT was a good thing, and it had been in short supply all year long. But there was a reluctance to consider financial remuneration for the work this case would entail. Bosch knew that everyone in the room would work whatever hours were needed, whether paid or not. "This is why we do this." Bosch thought about what Kiz Ryder had said to him earlier. It was all part of the mission, and this case told that tale better than most.
Chapter 38.
It took the three teams of detectives, assigned to the photographic and video evidence, 2 hours to package all the materials from the second bedroom closet into evidence boxes. As if in a solemn funeral procession, three unmarked cars then transported the boxes north to Los Angeles and the PAB. Bosch and Chu were in the last car, three boxes of still photos on the rear seat. There was little to talk about as they drove. They had a grim duty ahead of them, and thoughts of preparing for it were all-consuming. The media relations office had tipped the media to the arrival of the procession, and as the detectives carried their boxes into the police headquarters, they were documented by photographers and videographers lined up outside the building's entrance. This was not done simply to appease the media. Rather, it was part of what would be an ongoing effort to use the media to hammer home with the public and the local jury pool that Chilton Hardy was guilty of ghastly deeds. It was part of the subtle complicity that would always exist between the police and the media. All three of the meeting rooms had been assigned to what was being known as the Hardy Task Force. Bosch and Chu took the smallest room, because it did not have video equipment. They were going to sort through still photographs and didn't need it. Hardy had shown no apparent rhyme or reason in his cataloging of the photos. Old and new, the photographs were tossed into several shoeboxes and placed on the shelves of the closet. There was no writing on the front or back of any of them. Several photos were taken of the same individuals, but these might be spread across two or three different shoeboxes. As Bosch and Chu began to go through them, they attempted to group the photos in a variety of ways. First and foremost, they tried to put all photos of the same individual together. They then tried to estimate the age of the photos and to organize them chronologically. Some of the photos had date stamps on them, and these were helpful, though there was no way of knowing if the camera used had been set to the proper date. In most of the photos, the individual depicted alone or with Hardy, or a man's body assumed to be Hardy's, was clearly alive in the photograph. He or she was either engaged in a sex act, or in some cases smiling directly at the camera. In other cases, the depiction was of a person looking in fear, and sometimes pain, at the camera. Photos that had individual identifiers were placed in a priority category. These were victims who wore distinctive jewelry or had tattoos or facial moles. These markers would help the investigators seek identities later in the investigation. Bosch could feel his insides being hollowed by the process. The eyes of the victims were the most difficult. So many of them looked at the camera with eyes that knew they were not going to live. It tapped into a deep well of helpless rage in Bosch. For years, Hardy had cut a bloody trail across the landscape, and no one had seen it. Now they were left to make piles out of photographs. At one point, there was a knock on the door, and Teddy Baker came in holding a file.
"I thought you might want to see this," she said. "They took it at MDC during booking."
She opened the file and put an 8x10 photo down on the table. It depicted a man's back. Spread from shoulder blade to shoulder blade was a depiction of a cemetery with black crosses across the landscape. Some of the crosses were old and faded, the ink having spread with the skin. Some of the crosses were sharply drawn and looked new. In a black script beneath the image were the words, "Bene Decessit." Bosch had seen RIP tattoos before, but usually they were on gangbangers trying to keep track of the body counts of their own homies. This was new and yet not surprising. It also didn't come as a surprise that Hardy had found a tattoo artist who apparently didn't think the cemetery image was suspicious enough to contact authorities.
"That's your boy," Baker said.
"And did you count the crosses?" Bosch asked.
"Yeah."
There's 37 of them. Bosch had not told her or the others that Hardy had said his number was 37. He had only told Kiz Ryder that. He ran his finger below the words on Hardy's back.
Yeah,
Baker said.
We Googled it. Its Latin means died well. Like they all died well?
Bosch nodded.
Sweet, Chu said. The guy's fucked up.
Can we put the photo in the package? Bosch asked.
It's all yours.
Bosch put the photo to the side of the table. He would include it in the charging package he would take to the DA. Okay, thanks, Teddy, he said. He was dismissing her. He wanted to get back to the photo work. He needed to find Lily.
Do you guys need some help?
Baker asked.
Gandalf didn't give us a piece of anything. Out of sight, out of mind, I guess.
She and Keo had been driving Hardy to the MDC for booking when Gandalf had given out assignments. It was quickly becoming the kind of case everyone wanted a part of. I think we got this, Teddy, Bosch said quickly before his partner could tell her to join them. Maybe the others could use a hand with the videos.
Okay, thanks. I'll check with them.
Bosch interpreted her tone to mean that she thought he was being a selfish prick. She went to the door, but then turned back to them.
You know what's weird so far?
She asked. What's weird? Bosch responded.
No bodies. There's DNA in that townhouse, but where are all the bodies? Where did he hide them?
Some were found, Bosch said, like Lily Price. Others he hid. That's his last chit. By the time we're finished with this, that's all Hardy will have left to trade. He gives up the bodies, we give up the death penalty.
Think the DA will go for it?
I hope not. She left the room then, and Bosch got back to work with the photos.
Harry, what's up? Chu said. We've got about 1,000 photos still to look through.
I know that, Bosch said.
So why couldn't we use her? She and Keo are part of OU. They're just looking for something to do.
I don't know. I just think that if Lily Price is in here somewhere, then we should find her. Know what I mean?
I guess so.
Bosch relented. Go get her. Bring her back.
No, that's okay. I understand.
They went back to work, silently looking and sorting and stacking. Such a grim duty, and so many victims. If not of murder or rape, then of Hardy's manipulations and inhumanity. Bosch had to admit to himself that it was another reason he didn't want to bring Teddy Baker in. It didn't matter that she was a veteran investigator who had seen everything there was to see on the underside of life. And it didn't matter that Hardy was a predator who targeted weakness, whether the victim be male or female. Bosch would never be comfortable viewing the photos in the company of a woman. It was just the way he was. Only 20 minutes later, Bosch saw Chu stop his routine motion of checking a photo and then holding it up over his head as he considered the stack he would place it on. He looked over. Chu was studying a Polaroid.
Harry, I think...
Bosch took the photo from him and looked at it. It was a shot of a young girl lying naked on a dirty blanket. Her eyes were closed, and it was impossible to determine if she was alive or dead. The photo had faded over time. Bosch held it next to the yearbook photo of the smiling face of Lily Price, taken 18 months before her death.
You think? Chu asked.
Bosch didn't answer. He kept shifting his eyes from photo to photo, studying them and making minute comparisons. Chu handed him a magnifying glass he had brought from the cubicle, but neither had used. Bosch put both photos down on the table and compared them under magnification. Finally, he nodded and answered, "I think you found her. We take this over to photo for digital analysis and see what they say."
Chu pounded his fist on the table. "We got this guy, Harry. We got him."
Bosch put the magnifier down on the table and leaned back in his chair. "Yeah," he said. "I think we do." He then leaned forward and pointed to the stacks of photos that still had not been checked. "Let's keep going," he said.
You think there's more? Chu asked.
Who knows? Maybe. But there's also another one we should try to find.
Who?
Clayton Pell. He said Hardy took his picture, too. If he saved it, then it should be in here.
Chapter 39. Bosch gathered himself, took a final breath, and punched in the number. He wasn't even sure if the phone number would still be good after so many years. He checked one of the overhead clocks and did the math again. 2 hours ahead in Ohio. It would be well after dinner, but they would still be awake. A woman picked up after 3 rings.
Mrs. Price? Bosch asked.
Yes, who am I speaking to?
There was an urgent tone in her voice, and Bosch guessed that she had caller ID on her phone. She knew it was the police calling, reaching across time and distance.
Mrs. Price, this is Detective Bosch with the Los Angeles Police Department. I'm calling because there have been some developments in the investigation of your daughter's death. I need to talk with you.
Bosch heard the catch in her breath. Then she covered the receiver and spoke to someone else. He could not tell what she was saying.
Mrs. Price?
Yes, I'm sorry. I told my husband, Lily's father. He went upstairs to get on the other line.
Okay, we can wait for...
Is this about what they're showing on TV? We were watching the Fox Channel, and I had to wonder if that man they said is known as Chill was the one who took Lily.
She was crying before she finished the question.
Mrs. Price, can we... There was a click,
and they were joined on the line by her husband.
This is Bill Price.
Mr. Price,
I was telling your wife, my name is Harry Bosch. I'm a detective with the LAPD. I need to inform you about developments in the investigation of your daughter's death.
Lily,
Mr. Price said.
Yes, sir, your daughter Lily.
I work in the Open Unsolved Unit, which handles cold case homicide investigations. Last week we got a good break in the case. DNA from blood found on Lily's body was connected to a man named Chilton Hardy. It was not his blood, but it was blood that belonged to someone who knew Hardy and could connect him to the crime. I'm calling to tell you that we arrested Chilton Hardy today, and we will be charging him with your daughter's murder. There was only the sound of Mrs. Price weeping.
I don't know if there's any more to say at this point, Bosch finally said.
The investigation is still unfolding, and I will keep you posted on developments as we go forward with the prosecution. Once it is revealed that this man has been charged with your daughter's murder, you may be contacted by the news media. It is up to you whether you want to talk to them or not. Do you have any questions for me? Bosch tried to imagine them in their home in Dayton, on different floors, connected by an open phone line to a man they had never met. 22 years ago, they had sent their daughter to Los Angeles to go to college. She never came home.
I have a question, Mrs. Price said. Hold on, please.
Bosch heard the phone being put down, and then her weeping in the background. Her husband finally spoke.
Detective, thank you for not forgetting about our daughter. I'm going to hang up now, so I can go downstairs and be with my wife.
I understand, sir. I am sure we will be talking soon. Goodbye.
When Mrs. Price came back on the line, she had composed herself.
On the cable news, they said that the police were looking at pictures and videos of the victims.